Right, before we get into this week's podcast with John Motson, let's give you the inside story of how Sam and Alex broke the Mark Hughes story this week. It's a story that did emerge over the weekend, and as we were uploading this podcast, it broke. So, Crook, Sam, over to you.
Thanks, Michelle. Yeah, well, it's been an unbelievable morning, really, because we recorded most of the podcast last night, and we've been to see John Motson, and this morning was taken up with dealing with this Mark Hughes story. It was a story that I mentioned on TalkSport over the weekend, that his tenure at the club was coming to an end, we understood, and it's certainly gathered pace over the last 24 hours. I didn't get a response off someone that I expected to get a response off yesterday, and then Alex, you got a few rumbles as well, didn't you, overnight?
Yeah, the alarm bell started to ring for me because Southampton were due to hold their usual pre-match press conference at 2 o'clock on Monday. I text the press department on Sunday evening. They said, yeah, it is 2 o'clock. We just haven't sent the invite round. And I thought, well, that's strange, because normally they send round invites saying Mark Hughes will be addressing the media at this time. Well, clearly Mark Hughes wouldn't be addressing the media because he was to be relieved of his duties. So,
but he hadn't been told at that time?
No. So it wasn't actually announced officially until about 10 to 10 on the Monday morning, by which stage you and I had been in contact. You'd put your feelers out, I put my feelers out, and I actually got it confirmed about 10 minutes before the official release that Mark Hughes had been relieved of his duties and they were looking for a new manager. So I was able to tweet it, which is fantastic now, because once you tweet that, suddenly my phone was red hot. I had newspapers ringing me, I had TalkSport ringing me, I was on TalkSport throughout the day, and that's a great it's a great medium to show that I was the one who broke the story, and therefore I'm able then to, you know, to tell it to everybody.
Through. Yeah. Obviously, we'd had some little pointers in the direction of possible replacements. Hasan Hüttler, the manager formerly of Leipzig, and Ingolstadt, and Kike Sanchez Flores had been mentioned. Those two, I understand, both spoken to last week, but we believe the Austrian is the most likely, don't we now?
Yeah, and this is another strand to it, because when you get a breaking news story like that, you want to be able to take it forward. I didn't want to just say Mark Hughes has been fired, because everybody knows that. They've released a statement. So we then set about trying to find out who's going to replace him. Flores had been backed into bookmaker's favourite. Doesn't necessarily take a lot of money to make that happen in the market, but we knew via your information that he was one of two candidates who had been spoken to last week. We then found out via sources over in Germany that the former RB Leipzig manager was the second one, and actually he was the one who was going to get the job. So I filed that copy. I then got to write a comment piece this afternoon for The Sun on why Mark Hughes went, why it didn't work out for him, why is this guy the right man, is it a gamble? So there's all kinds of strands now to this breaking news story, but I've got to say it's the most exciting part of the job.
Yeah, and just on the Mark Hughes situation and why he's been relieved of his duties, I've been speaking to people who have worked closely with him, and the suggestion is that they feel hard done by, because they weren't really in control of the transfer situation there. We know that there's a head of football, Ross Wilson, who does a lot of the transfer work, and he spent £40 million on a replacement for Dusan Tadic in El Yunusi, and Vestergaard as well, who I suppose is the long-term replacement for the defenders that they sold many years ago in Fonten and Van Dijk. But ultimately, these players, I don't think the coaching staff felt were good enough to be in the first team. They were trying to put the pieces together from a very difficult jigsaw puzzle. Now, the only accusation you can then level back at them, I suppose, is that they've only won 3 of 22 Premier League games. But it seems very strange that they were given 3-year contracts in the summer and have been relieved of their duty before we've got to Christmas.
Well, first and foremost, it's hard to feel sorry for a sack manager, because Mark Hughes will walk away with a two years of severance money.
Of course.
That's a seven-figure sum, so let's say that. But yes, listen, this is a drum that I've been banging for probably 3 years now, that the fault at Southampton is not solely with the man in the dugout.
The problems are much bigger than that.
It's a recruitment problem. Since Paul Mitchell, ironically now at RB Leipzig, could well come back with a new manager, left the club, Ross Wilson came in as head of recruitment, the recruitment's been poor. Les Reed carried the can for that, because he was quick to bask in the glory when they were recruiting good players, not so quick to bask in it when they were recruiting bad players. Ultimately, it's been 3 years of buying bad players to replace good players they've sold. That is going to come back and haunt you. And I don't think whoever comes in is going to wave a magic wand and that's going to improve overnight. They're still going to have Wesley Hoot at centre-half, who's one of the worst defenders in the Premier League. They're still going to have Vestergaard, who, as you say, is probably not up to it. So it's a massive job whoever comes in.
OK, that's enough Southampton chat. We've got to speak to John Motson. We've got to talk about Jose Mourinho in the tunnel. And we've got to hear from Michelle. Let's get on with the rest of the podcast.
This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of All Football Commentators Are Geeks with me, Michelle Owen from Sky Sports and Soccer Saturday.
Sam Matterface from Talk Sport and ITV.
Alex Crook from Talk Sport and a very special guest geek.
And I'm John Motson.
Yes, we are all super excited to have Motty on the podcast. Also coming up today, Crook will be telling us a very telling tale from the tunnel involving Jose Mourinho and Ed Woodward.
Yes, and as you can imagine, after Saturday's draw with Saints, the tunnel was not a happy place at St Mary's, unlike at Stamford Bridge, where it was all a little bit of a loving. Details coming up.
And after Michelle was left frazzled by covering a brilliant 5-5 draw, we will be recalling some of our highest scoring matches.
All that on the podcast that will give Motty Sheepskin Coat a knighthood. All football commentators are geeks.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
So, boys, I've taken a print screen from Sam's Insta story of you two gazing into each other's eyes because you were together this weekend, and what a bromance it is that you clearly have.
I was fluttering my eyelids across the table, but you know, we were going to share a double bed in a hotel room on Saturday night, but it just didn't work out. There was a camp bed in there. He was so gutted when I found the sofa bed, weren't you?
I've never been more relieved in my life.
Yeah, right. You just wait a cuddle. It's okay.
But you had a lovely time.
We did. We had a lovely time. We had a romantic curry on Saturday night, very late.
Very tasty, though.
Wow. And which game were you at together, guys?
We were at Southampton, Manchester United.
That was great. That was one. Sam was sat behind me, and every time Southampton scored, I just got a thump in the back. Cheers for that.
Obviously, Crook, because, yes, you're a United fan. Yeah. Well, what a weekend it was in the Premier League, with no fewer than three big derby matches. I'm slightly frazzled because I was on Sky Sports News today and we're across them all, and they were fantastic. Another miserable Saturday afternoon for Jose Mourinho, and there were some big results down at the bottom of the table. So let's take a look at the biggest stories in numbers.
Arsenal won the North London bragging rights with a thrilling 4-2 win at home to Tottenham despite trailing 2-1 at half-time. The first time in 9 years they've come from behind at half-time to beat their bitter rivals.
And in the other big derby match on Sunday, Liverpool left it very late to beat Everton 1-0, courtesy of a mistake from Jordan Pickford. The Reds now enjoying their longest ever unbeaten run against the Toffees, stretching 18 matches.
Meanwhile, Manchester City stay top after defeating Bournemouth 3-1 at the Etihad. But arguably the most remarkable statistic from that game was that Callum Wilson became the first midfielder or striker to score against the champions all season.
Well, the problems then mounting for Jose Mourinho with United. Now, can you believe it? 16 points off the top of the table. Now, Sam and Crook, we know you were both at the Southampton game on Saturday. How was the special one after the game?
Do you know what? I felt a little bit sorry for Jose after the game. It must be an absolute nightmare trying to run that team. I am not, before you jump in, Crook, saying that he is blameless, but Pogba is a nightmare. Rashford, shot of confidence. There's injuries all over the place. I don't know whether or not some of those injuries are ones that you would probably play with if you weren't playing for Jose Mourinho, but I reckon there's a bit of that going on as well. The idea that the club is run as a commercial business first, football club second, that can't be helped. The scouting network obviously isn't as good as he thought it was when he walked in the door. But, you know, I've dived in with a few questions about the performance with him. He bemoaned the fact that he only had one fit centre-half. He says Bailly's injured. Obviously, he doesn't fancy Rocco, who's on the bench. He was fine. He even offered, actually, to wait for Crook to finish doing Mark Hughes so he could come and stand and join us. It was quite courteous of him, actually.
That's unusual, right?
No, he's all right, Jose. He's okay. I think he gets a bit of a bad press, really. In terms of, you know, people think that he's rude. He's not rude. And then about four questions into the interview, I think he sensed I was going to ask him about a conversation that he was having prior to the interview. And he just walked off and said, no, it's finished now. Goodbye. To be fair, I had told Crook that this was going to happen.
Yeah,
because one, I knew he wouldn't be happy, and two, I knew that I was going to keep going until I was told to stop. So it was predicted, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. What was the question you were going to ask him?
I was going to ask him what Ed Woodward said to him when he was caught round the corner.
That was an incredible insight to me. So we stood around waiting in the... it's quite a small interview area at St Mary's. There's various different compartments with the different TV companies set up. And as it happens, the radio interviews take place immediately in front of the doors leading into the dressing room area. So we have a really good vantage point. And Jose, for about 10 minutes immediately after the full-time whistle, was sat, much like a naughty schoolboy getting a ticking off from the headmaster, with Ed Woodward. And Jose was sat on those big metallic boxes that the kit men used to transport the kit up and down the country. Slumped. I'd love to have been a fly on the wall for that conversation. It lasted for about 10 minutes, as I say. And then he came past us in the interview area. Before he did his interview, he said, no, I need a couple of minutes. And he went out and took a call on his mobile phone. So putting two and two together, was that a call to his agent saying, I'm a football manager, get me out of here?
No. Who knows?
It was interesting, though, because you say we'd want to be flies on the wall, but we were flies on the wall. The only thing we didn't have
was the sound.
We didn't catch any of the actual exchange between the two.
Just the body language.
We could see them, and we could see the body language, and it was just a bit strange. In fact, one of the reporters down there, and I won't tell you which one it was, took a picture of it. I don't think he's tweeted it out and put it on social media, but the picture is pretty... It's not great. If it got out there, I think it would be used, I'm sure.
So, Sam, you're saying from this photo, if we could all see it, if we could all see what you and Crook have seen, it wasn't a positive conversation.
It wasn't a positive conversation. And look, I know that he and Ed Woodward exchange messages after every game if Ed Woodward isn't there or if they're in a place where they can't get to one another. But... it was a terrible performance. He tried to say that, in fact, he did say to me that it's a difficult place to come and it's a difficult opponent with good strikers. At which point, my head's like going crazy. Hold on a second. This is a team that before today had only scored 10 goals. You know, it was one of the worst attacks, actually, in the league. And he said he didn't care about the table or what the table told you about Southampton. The fact is, he knew that they were a good team and he thought it was going to be a test. And it was a test for Manchester United. I've seen Southampton a few times this season. I've seen Manchester United more than I'd cared to. And let's be completely honest about it. They aren't a very good team.
No, well, I don't think anybody would argue with that. On the subject of being a fly on the wall, there were clearly some flies on the walls of the United dressing room, both at the team hotel and at St Mary's, because there were two really big stories that have come out this weekend. First of all, in the Mail on Sunday this morning, I was annoyed because it knocked my quotes piece with Jose off the back page. But Simon Jones, one of their reporters, has basically done a piece claiming that Mourinho gave his players a dressing down before the match at the team hotel. They were staying at the Hilton Hotel at the Aegeus Bowl, formerly the Rose Bowl, which is where Hampshire cricket play. And apparently, Jose has given them a telling off about their performances before a ball has even been kicked. Now, how has that information got out? Is it a player? Is it a member of the coaching staff? Could it be Ed Woodward himself? That isn't beyond the realms, by the way. And then another story has emerged today. Apparently, in front of his teammates, Jose has labelled Paul Pogba a virus in the Manchester United dressing room in the immediate aftermath of what happened on Saturday. Apparently, Jose told him he showed a lack of respect to his teammates, supporters and the club. You don't play, you don't respect players and supporters, you kill the mentality of the good, honest people around you. You are like a person with a flu, with a virus in a closed room. You pass that virus to others. Now, having seen Paul Pogba's performance on Saturday...
He was absolutely bang on.
I agree. But how has that information come out? Now, I've been told by more than one source... I've been told by more than one source in recent weeks that most of the leaks coming out of Manchester United, including that story about Jose Mourinho getting the boot before the game against Newcastle, you may remember, come from Ed Woodward himself. Mm-hmm. He actually briefs the journalists.
Yeah, and that's not a new thing. That's something that's been going on for a long, long time. Long, long time.
That so is if he's Ed Woodward...
Hold on. Who's he briefing?
He's briefing. There's a pool of journalists in the Northwest that he is close with, and right. he briefs them on a regular. He's always briefed them on a regular occasion. He takes them out for lunch, and he says, "Oh, this is off the record. That's off the record," and blah 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 blah. But these stories all end up coming out.
Yeah,
right. Which is incredible when you think that. Arguably, despite Mad. The current league table, this is still the biggest club in the world.
It's a very different atmosphere in the old Chelsea tunnel, though. On Sunday afternoon, early kickoff, we had Sarri and Ranieri down there. Sarri had invited Ranieri to stay at his house for 4 days earlier in the year. They're all big mates. He admired him. He grew up as a coach, watching Fiorentina and learning off of... Claudio Ranieri did Maurizio Sarri, and Sarri actually said to us afterwards, right, it was so funny, someone said to him, "What did you were you all right today, did you enjoy today?" And he said, "Oh, it was so emotional for me, so emotional, I got a little bit sort of choked up." And why is that? "Oh, it's Claudio Ranieri, it's when I used to watch him when I was younger." And they're not a dissimilar age, but I think what? He came into it quite late. Do you know what I mean? He was talking about when he was a young coach and he was trying to learn, and Claudio Ranieri was this big star in Italy. So around about sort of the 2000 mark, that's when Ranieri's star was high, of course, before he came to Chelsea. In fact, probably the late 90s. By that stage, I think Maurizio Sarri was still part-time banking. Do you know what I mean? So he wasn't a full-time manager. But he obviously got a clear amount of admiration for him. And he got all misty-eyed when reminiscing about his love of Claudio Ranieri. So it was a good relationship for him. What have you seen in the tunnels this week, Michelle?
I'm afraid compared to you guys, it's a little bit dull. I was just a little bit... I've been in two tunnels, haven't I? First of all, the Villa one, after the 5-5 game. And I just said... to both managers, I said to Ita Karanka, I said to Dean Smith, I was like, "Guys, to be honest, I don't really know where to start. I mean, where do you start?" And we'll come on to that a little bit later. And they were both great and they were both lovely. And then at Nottingham Forest on Saturday, when they beat Ipswich 2-0, sometimes you have to wait a little while at Forest. And then Ita Karanka came out, we did his post-match. And the worst thing you can do is miss a manager in the Championship while you're speaking to another. Because they go and do club TV and then they do radio and then they do local press. And without exaggeration, it just takes twice as long. So waited a long time to do a 2-minute interview with Paul Lambert, but did really feel for him, just to touch on the Championship for a second, because Ipswich are rock bottom and I could see there's a massive technical area at the City Ground. And he was prowling around, he was telling his players how to play, trying to get them playing out from the back, and it just did not work for him. He's got to try and scrape by, he said himself. Got to try and get through to January now and be in the mix then.
I think you needed a little bit more of Jose's courtesy there, didn't you? Paul Lambert could have just waited for you, couldn't he? Just for a couple of seconds and invited you over. I mean, why not?
And you'd think he'd want to get on the bus home.
It's funny that managerial merry-go-round involving Ipswich, isn't it? Because Mick McCarthy was fired. Oh. He's now got an international job. They took the manager from Shrewsbury. He was fired. The guy that Shrewsbury took, I think, from Macclesfield to replace Paul Hurst, he's been fired.
Yep.
And the guy that Macclesfield then appointed has also been fired. Didn't work out well for anybody, apart from Mick McCarthy, that.
Sometimes you should just stick, shouldn't you?
Yeah. You're listening to the All Football Commentators are Geeks podcast. And remember, you can follow on Instagram or get in touch with us via Twitter. The handles are exactly the same. We are at AFC Geeks. Send us your questions and we'll answer as many of them as we can in the next episode.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.
Right, guys, it's time for another round of Stat or Spin. I'll kick us off this week and it's a stat about a team you both saw at the weekend, so you should be able to guess if this is Stat or Spin.
Lift off and the clock has started.
Okay, Southampton have now led in 6 Premier League games this season, but they've converted all those leads into just one win. Stat or Spin?
Ooh, I think it might be 5, not 6. I'm going to go Spin.
It's a lot, isn't it?
You're the South Coast correspondent for a national radio station. Really and truly, this is your patch.
Me to tweet the other day that I wouldn't trust Southampton to walk my dog because they're rubbish at holding on to leads.
Hey.
I'm going to say Stat, actually. I think it might be as many as 6.
So, Sam, it was 5 before this weekend, so it is now 6.
So the South Coast correspondent lives another day.
He
just about.
He knows his stuff.
He knows his stuff. I did a great interview with Cedric Suarez in which he nicked a line that I used in commentary on Saturday, and I went to him, yeah, I know, you heard that when I did the commentary, and he went, yeah, I'm just saying, I was listening.
Someone has to.
Oh, dear. Okay, here's a stat for you. This is from the game that I did on Sunday between Chelsea and Fulham. Do you know that Fulham have now only won at Stamford Bridge once in 25 top flight visits? And the last time that they won at Stamford Bridge was March 1974. It was the start of Radio Caroline, a pirate radio station. We'll have to educate you, Michelle, on that. The first 10
pound
notes...
No, I know all about it.
Were printed, and Harold Wilson was in number 10. And even more interestingly than that, the manager at the time's name was Bedford Jezzard.
So I was looking at this game for Sky Sports News today, and I don't think they even met between 1990 and 2001 in any competition at all. So I think this is a stat.
See, all I'm thinking about is the fact that my wife and I have been discussing baby names should she become pregnant, and we haven't considered Bedford.
I wouldn't consider it if I was you.
I bet he'd be the only Bedford at school.
I bet he would as well. That'll spin.
You two are so confident, it's got to be a stat.
It is a stat, correct. Unbelievable, isn't it? 1964, the last time they won at Stamford Bridge. Crook, what you got for us?
Well, I had the honour of commentating the North London Derby for Talk Sports International arm. It was fantastic. Sometimes these big games don't live up to their top billing. This was absolutely sensational. And one of the most remarkable elements of it was that Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang scored twice. Nothing unusual about that. But what does make it unusual is that he's now scored 16 goals in 17 Premier League games played on a Sunday. That accounts for 80% of the goals he scored in the Premier League.
He does love a Sunday. He does love a Sunday. He loves a goal. He's got a fantastic goals to minutes ratio, that boy. I actually first saw him in the African Cup of Nations many years ago playing for Gabon when he used to have a very odd hairstyle, but he was always a talented, talented player. I'm going to say that is spin because I know that you like to manipulate figures and he's probably got like 15 or 18 or something.
I know, Crook, you do like to manipulate figures. That's the thing that's making a little bit sceptical. So he scored loads, but I think, yeah, there's probably just a little tweak in there from you. So I'll say spin.
I hope HMRC aren't listening to you two. You're not giving me a very good character reference, are you? It's actually a stat.
Oh, you've gone straight for once.
Wow.
I have.
I was going to say, he's being honest.
Well, that doesn't happen very often, so we better note that down.
If you like the podcast, make sure you rate and review it on iTunes and subscribe via your podcast supplier. Next up, we will be joined by the Oracle of football commentary himself, none other than Match of the Day legend John Watson.
They don't know how to make small talk, but they do know when Raheem Sterling last scored for England. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
You are listening to a very special episode of All Football Commentators Are Geeks. Now, we've had some massive names from the world of broadcasting since we started up, but none bigger than our next guest, the voice of football for more years than he would probably care to remember, the one and only John Motson. Sam and I went to meet Motty in the salubrious surroundings of the TalkSport canteen.
So we're sitting in the TalkSport canteen with John Motson, the legendary John Motson. Thank you very much for joining us on All Football Commentators Are Geeks. Now, one of the geekiest things that we all talk about more than anything else is the way we make our notes, and your notes have been your pride and joy over the course of the years, and we've all seen them. Would you say they were artwork?
No, I wouldn't say that. I'd say they're very old-fashioned, because of course I was starting off very much in the pre-website and pre-computer and club channel age, and I kind of developed a system which, well, it's seen me through many, many years, and I've chosen not to change it, really. I mean, I was told early on, always put your notes on a piece of card so they don't blow away, which is an obvious bit of advice. So I used to, well, what I do is I have a sheet with the teams on one side, and then on the back I have all the sequences and the statistics which apply to the two clubs at the time. I suppose the thing that stands out about mine is I do it all in felt tip pen or a little bit of biro. Very much handmade, I have to say.
You haven't transferred to Apple Pencil and iPad yet?
No, I haven't, no. And I get, if you like, I'm doing Arsenal Huddersfield for TalkSport on Saturday, so Arsenal will be in red and the Huddersfield names will be in blue and the Christian names will be in another colour, probably green, and the numbers will be in black. And similarly on the back, with my other stats, I alternate the colours so that they stand out a bit more when I'm... as you know better than me, you know, there's not much time to look down and read your notes. It's what you put in your mind by writing them in the first place. But I try not to have everything in the same colour so it becomes a big mass that I can't distinguish one thing from the other. So that system, I suppose, has held me in good stead for quite a few years. I mean, I have all the goal scorers listed as well. And obviously things like the referee and that sort of stuff. And then... I hope by writing that down meticulously on a day or sometimes 2 days before, but certainly the night before, any late changes, I have a little packet of stickers that I stick over the player who's not been selected and write somebody else's name in when I get the team sheet. That's always a last-minute thing. And really, that's been the backdrop to what I do all those years.
You were not... the first, but one of the first, and certainly developed a reputation for being quite into statistics.
Yes.
Was that an unfair label?
No, not at the time. I did use a lot of stats, and I did try and come up with facts and figures that other people might not, or may either not know or get thoroughly bored with. But I'll tell you what, Sam, when I look at the number of statistics now, in the morning newspaper on a Monday, on Sky... I mean, some of the obscure things that appear now, even I would never have dared to have researched or used in those days. I mean, mine were fairly basic. You know, it was his it was his 100th goal or his 300th appearance. Or, I mean, I can't believe some of the stuff now with the diagrams and the number of passes with one foot and the... I just can't get it. So now...
Two expected goals.
Well, no, I'm not into that. And do you know something? As a result of that, I probably... And this is not supposed to be because I'm lazy, but I probably do less homework now than I did then. Simply because I could never come up with half the stuff that's appearing now. So I've almost oversimplified my system and my approach, really. But yes, in the early days, people used to say, oh, not another statistic, Motti, and... Because they weren't, in those days, they weren't appearing by the dozen in national newspapers. And there was no Sky, not much graphic or visual stuff on the screen. And I kind of thought I was adding something by going to the trouble of finding out, you know, what were the right connotations. So it's gone in reverse, really.
You're someone who's almost synonymous with the BBC. When you think of Motti, you think of Match of the Day. Now, of course, at this... vintage stage of your career, you switched to commercial radio. How have you found that?
I've loved it. It's been a breath of fresh air for me, really. I mean, I had wonderful years at the BBC. They certainly, in my early years in radio, they trained me to be a broadcaster. Then I had that long period with Match of the Day, where, of course, I was lucky enough to cover, I don't know, 200 England games and lots of cup finals and World Cups and stuff like that. And then, obviously, when I got to the 50-year anniversary, which we'd agreed would be my stepping off point from the BBC, I realised that was going to be the I knew that was going to be the end of my television career, but I didn't necessarily think I was finished in radio. I mean, the BBC may have done, but luckily for me, TalkSport approached me in the middle of my last season and said, would I like to, you know, work here? And and I have to say, from my point of view, I can't speak for them, it's been a fairly seamless transition because I'm doing a lot of stuff that I would have done at the BBC. But what's nice about it is I'm getting more opportunity in terms of minutes on the air because doing, the TalkSport 3 o'clock commentary on a Saturday, I'm on from 2 till 3 talking about Premier League affairs and then doing the whole game. Now, you've got to remember, of course, in my latter years at Match of the Day, my match on a Saturday would be edited down to 7 or 8 minutes. Even though I'd have done the 90 and researched it in a thorough way, my exposure was, well, you could blink and miss it. Whereas now, of course, I'm on for the whole game, obviously with a co-commentator, with Alvin Martin or Perry Groves. But everybody's been very supportive. And, of course, my other main regular role has been the Monday and Friday with Hawksby and Jacobs, when we look ahead on a Friday to the Premier League programme, and then, like a day like today, Monday, we will look back on what happened over the weekend. And my goodness me, there's plenty happened this weekend. I'm not sure that we're going to have the time. But that's the basic. And then, of course, the other thing that Liam Fisher, the editor, his idea, came up with was Motti Meets, which is a series of 10 prolonged interviews, if you know what I mean. He used the word bespoke, but I don't quite know what that means. Anyway, I do an hour with, and the criteria, it's quite interesting really, is that I have to have been present at that person's most memorable moment in the game. So, for example, the first one was Bobby Gould winning the FA Cup with Wimbledon in 88. The second one was Ronnie Radford and his great goal for Hereford. Today I should be doing David Pleat running on the pitch when he kept Luton in the First Division. And then next week, Gerry Armstrong talking about his memorable goal for Northern Ireland in the World Cup in 82. And we're going to do 10 of these. They're obviously being recorded at the moment, but they will go out as a live program, as a broadcast program, as from the FA Cup third round in January.
So when your contract came to an end at the BBC,
yeah,
did you feel you were going to retire? Because at the time, it was a big thing about you retiring, wasn't there?
Well, yes, and that was other people's use of the word retirement. I knew that I was finishing at the BBC at the end of that season, yes. But of course, I knew from about, I don't know, February, March onwards, that I would be doing some more radio work for TalkSport. So it didn't wind me up too much. In fact, people still say to me now, how's retirement? Or they did at the very beginning of the season. But now more and more people are saying, heard you on TalkSport the other day. And then I say, well, now there you are. You see, I haven't retired. So, yeah, it was a bit of a mixture. But it was nice, actually, because I finished at the BBC at the end of the World Cup when I'd been doing a few things for radio. And then started with TalkSport almost immediately. So there was no time, fortunately, I didn't have any time to feel either depressed or whatever I might have felt about the end of my broadcasting career, because I knew it was going to continue.
Have you had to change your broadcasting and style of broadcasting over the years?
It's a good question. Well, funnily enough, you could have said, have I had to change it for TalkSport? They've changed me in a very good way, because I feel I can express myself more freely working at TalkSport. I mean, it was a great privilege to work for the BBC, don't get me wrong. But, you know, there was a certain format to the shows which I had to observe. I find here, particularly with Hawksby and Jacobs, that the conversation, it kind of flows, but you can sort of more or less direct it in any way you feel at the time. And I just feel that my experience, such as it is probably being used in a slightly wider way. And certainly with the long interviews, questions I've wanted to ask for years, if you know what I'm, the sort of questions, I can now sort of have the freedom to sort of take that along those lines. And the commentaries, I wouldn't say I've changed my commentary style, but again, in the company of the co-commentator, I feel as though I've relaxed a bit more into the conversational mode, and long may it last.
It's interesting. Do you feel the BBC has modernised enough in the way that other people have with the way they cover football? Because Match of the Day has been the same format for a long time now. If you look at the way that Sky do Monday Night Football, for example, lots of innovations there, and it has been levelled at Match of the Day that really they haven't changed with the times. Do you share that view?
Well, I don't think Sky have changed that much with the times. I mean, I think their format is very much what it was when they came on the air in 1992, isn't it? I don't see Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher on a Monday night doing anything different. So consequently, I could say that, I mean, the point about Match of the Day is it's such an iconic programme. I mean, when you think that over 5 million people are watching it every Saturday night, and it started in 1964, and I don't really think people would want too much change. I mean, Lineker is peerless. You get the goals from every Premier League game. You get good analysis, I think, particularly from Shearer and Danny Murphy. And I think it might be dangerous to tamper with it, is my view. I think it's an established part of people's lives, if I could put it that strongly. And I don't think you can... I mean, basically, at the end of it all, we're all talking about showing a football match or football matches and sort of explaining as quickly... Well, I say as quickly, but as succinctly as you can, exactly what went on that day. And in the time span that they have, I don't think I would change it. I think it's an established part of people's lives. But I don't accept that Sky have innovated anything terribly new in the last 10 years. I mean, they're still interviewing the fans. I really think that, you know, I suppose the devil you know and all that for football viewers, they expect their kind of football fare to be served up pretty much the way it always has been. As I said, it's a good question, but I can't think of a way that you would radically change those programmes without reducing their appeal.
On the same basis, how important do you think it is that we do still have highlights on terrestrial TV on a Saturday night?
Well, I think it's essential. I mean, I think... I mean, the live football thing, of course, I saw it from the very beginning. I mean, there weren't any live matches when I started with Barry Davis. Two match highlights on a Saturday night, and we weren't even allowed to show the other goals. Live football crept in the 80s, and then, of course, the explosion was Sky in 1992. But I must admit, I never thought the day would come when there were several live matches every night, if you know where to find them. I mean, it's more work for more commentators, good luck. But, I mean... when I started doing live games, it was seen as a sort of a rare event, be it an England game or a cup final or... not so much now, where I'm afraid they all... Sort of the danger is that some of them all merge into one. I mean, you get an outstanding day like yesterday with three derby games, but then you're looking at matches on every night of the week and some of them from quite obscure places.
Obviously, when you were... commentating at your very peak, you were the voice of football in everyone's home. It's very different now, isn't it? Because there are so many outlets, so many commentators, so many presenters, so many pundits.
Yes.
Do you think that you will ever be in that situation again where we have someone as recognisable as you being the voice of football?
Well, it depends how those people develop and how they work at it, I suppose. I mean, I'm not going to say there'll never be another person who was put in the position that I was in. Far from it. I mean, there were only two channels when I started, and Barry Davis and myself on the BBC and Brian Moore and Jerry Sinstat on ITV, they were the recognisable voices because that's all the football there was. I think it is harder for this generation because, yes, you're right. I mean, if you take a programme with, say, 8 or 9 matches in it, or 8 or 9 programmes over a given period... you're hearing 8 or 9 different voices, and I guess if you were to say to a viewer, well, who was commentating on that match last night, they might find it harder to identify with him or her because there are so many more commentators now than there were then, but they've all got a job to do. I think the guy that might eventually come out and be the number one is probably the guy, I say guy, why shouldn't it be a lady? A guy or a girl who comes out to become the number one is probably going to be the person who, because if I'm ever asked for my advice, I say this to potential commentators. Sometimes I was never just a commentator. I mean, at the BBC in my early days, I went out every week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, to do a football focus story and get to know the managers and the players and interview people. Now, I'm not pointing the finger at any channel or any commentator here, but I don't think there's enough of that now. I think commentary has sort of drifted into being a full-time job. And I think perhaps when I hear one or two commentators doing interviews, not that I want to be critical, but that was a good performance today, Jose. I mean, I was taught always to ask a question that had a little bit of a why, you know, where, when, ring to. I know, yeah, exactly. I think if I was a young commentator now starting or you know, got an opportunity, I think I would make sure that I got out, because it's so easy to sit in your armchair during the week and watch whatever live match is on. I think if I was a young commentator now, I would still do what I did, because I had to then, get out in the week and make some contacts and get people's phone numbers. And, you know, David Coleman once said to me, you'll find out more about the game when you're not working than when you are. I know what he meant, and that was a good piece of advice. But having said all of that, it's a new generation. They're carving their own niche, and I wish them all the luck in the world. But the job hasn't changed that much. But those are just my thoughts on it.
Well, guys, I'm so very jealous that you went to meet him in person, and it's just incredible to have Motti on our podcast. And he'll be back a little bit later in the programme to answer our quick fire questions. And next, we will be looking ahead to a full midweek programme of Premier League matches and talking about the highest scoring games we've seen.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Welcome back to All Football Commentators Are Geeks. John Motson will be back with us very shortly. Absolutely delighted that Motti's on the programme today. Let's cast our eye over a rare round of Tuesday and Wednesday night games in the Premier League, and specifically, who's covering what? I'm covering... Oh, no, hold on. No, I'm going to the pub to watch Man United Arsenal. I think I'm off on Tuesday and Wednesday. Michelle, what games are you going to?
I'm going to a game of Quidditch. Because I'm going to Harry Potter World. There's actually only a small number of midweek games, so I get to go to Harry Potter World instead. What about you, Crook? You having a nice time like we are?
How does this work? I thought Crook? I'm the one who's supposed to not do any work.
Is this the first time that we're relaxing actually going to do some work?
Well, it's incredible. Two press conferences to cover on Monday, one at Bournemouth, and then Tuesday night, Bournemouth-Huddersfield. I know, I can tell you're excited by that.
Sounds like a belter. How do we get a ticket?
Michelle's off to Harry Potter World. I don't think there'll be much wizardry at the Vitality. Put it that way. It's going to be cold. It's going to be dank. Yeah, but they're struggling a bit, aren't they? Four successive defeats.
Yeah.
But they go through spells like this. Bournemouth go through spells like that where they lose a rash of games and then they recover and they'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, Callum Wilson always scores against Huddersfield, so get your money on that.
Well, hopefully you'll get some goals, Crook, like I did last midweek when I was very busy. Aston Villa 5, Nottingham Forest 5. Now, look, I never thought I'd see a game like this because last season I was meant to be at Bristol City v Hull. I got pulled off at last minute and had to go to Exeter, which is fine. But that game between Bristol City and Hull was 5-5. And I was like, well, that's it. That's my once-in-a-lifetime chance to see like 10 goals in a game.
It's that sliding doors
moment,
well,
actually,
isn't it? You think you're never going to get to do it again.
But this is what, 6 months later, and it's happened again. I was at the game and it's frantic, isn't it? You know, I'm sure you guys must have had a game like this where you're like, hold on a minute, what is the score? And I remember when Villa took the lead 5-4, I was thinking to myself, is this the first time they've taken the lead tonight? I don't even know. And it was funny. It was at the point it was funny. And we've been there, haven't we?
Ten goals, isn't it? 5-5 is 10 goals. I mean, I think that's not that many, is it, Crook? I've definitely done 11. You've done 11, haven't you?
I haven't done 11.
You haven't done 11?
I know the game that you're talking about. I wasn't there that day.
What game?
Portsmouth 7.
7-4.
Reading 4.
Yeah. Yeah, I knew you were going to say that.
It was crackers. It was absolutely crackers. And Harry Redknapp said afterwards, I lost count. And actually was furious. And I said, well, why are you furious? It was a brilliant game. And he went, no, it wasn't. It was the worst set of defending I've ever seen from both teams. And he was right. It was pretty poor. In fact, the first ever commentary game that I did was a 4-4 draw between Wimbledon and Gillingham many, many, many years ago. That was a cracker. That was my first introduction to football commentary. Brilliant. I thought from then on in, this is going to be great.
I had that 4-4 that I talked about in an earlier podcast, Chelsea against Villa on a cold Boxing Day, but I think that's my record, 8 goals. I don't think I can recall any 5-4s or certainly no 5-5s. I mean, how do you deal with that, Michelle, when goals are going in left, right and centre? Do you have a constant list in front of you that so that you can keep reminding yourself of who's done what?
Yeah, definitely. But to be fair, it was quite straightforward on last Wednesday evening because Tammy Abraham scored four for Aston Villa. And you just need to... I mean, it's pretty common sense, isn't it? But when he stepped up for the penalty, you know, you just say there's only one man in Villa Park that's going to take this. He's on a first-half hat-trick and that's quite straightforward. But Joe Lolley for Forest, he got... a hat-trick of assists. Then he got another assist and he scored a goal. So there were some really standout players, but it was just madness. And it was like every time we went to a break, someone scored. And as you know, we don't really have replays or anything like that. But on evenings like this, we run the goals in. So you're like, well, I hope what I'm saying is right because I'm commentating over it as it's happening, but I can't see it.
That's
and in a game like
really
that, it's so
point,
crazy.
That is a really good point. So you're at Villa Park and you're commentating over goals that are going out on Sky Sports News, but you can't see the reverse vision, can you? You can't see what they're playing out.
That's right.
You can only sort of use your imagination to recall what you've seen in your with your own eyes.
And try and match it to the time. Because
that's pressure.
When you
that
do
is
it,
pressure.
Yeah, because for Soccer Saturday, it's such a busy programme. They can't give you counts the whole time because they're moving on to the next thing. Look, if you're on your own just doing a game for Sky Sports News of an evening, they can give you a count. But when you're on Soccer Saturday, like you just have to talk to pace. And so when we have like a penalty like we did for Tammy Abraham, Carly, the producer, just says instant first. So you speak as long as you hope the instant was. And then what you're listening for is the playback in your ear of the referee blowing the whistle for the penalty. And that's how I do it. And then I speak over it. And,
brilliant.
I've watched them back. And it is. Yeah, it's a little bit hard. And what's funny is I watched it back with my husband because he hadn't seen the goals. So when we got home, I watched it. And he said, you look more and more frazzled as the goals go in, but only because your hair's just got messier because it's windy. My hair was just more and more out of place as the evening went on. But honestly, best game I've ever done. I loved it.
It's good. It's really good fun. And I thought some social media, great things on social media this week. Jules Warren, who presents that programme after that match, his social media, his Instagram post of him collapsing on the chair in this soccer special studio was brilliant. And the other Instagram post that I really liked this week was your tour of the Nottingham Forest gantry, where you have to... We spoke about it on the first ever pod that we did, the Nottingham Forest gantry, and you did a video of it, didn't you, on the way up to the point the other day.
Did.
And it was you ducking in and out of the stanchions.
Do you know... Yeah, I should have saved that because it's so funny. You guys might be too old for this, but I had Funhouse growing up. Anyone who's my age had Funhouse.
I'm not too old for Funhouse.
Okay, you can come with me on this one. But it just reminds me when they used to duck and dive and try and find things. So I was like, right, I'm going to run it as quick as I can. And then when we stopped filming, I carried on. And the next stanchion, I just whacked my head in. And that just serves me right, really. But it's the most ridiculous gantry you'll ever go on.
It is good.
I've just thought of another high-scoring game I was involved in, actually. It was only 6-0. Bournemouth against Wrexham. In what was the old second division, now League One. It was back in 2004, so 14 years ago now. Now, what was remarkable about this game was that James Hayter came off the bench and scored the quickest hat-trick in Football League history, 140 seconds. Now, that was a challenge because we knew it was quick, but we couldn't really prove conclusively on a Tuesday night before the internet was quite as developed as it is now, was it the quickest hat-trick of all time? So we had to take a little bit of a punt on that, just based on the fact we couldn't find anybody who scored a quicker one. So I put that in all the various national papers. James Hayter scored the quickest hat-trick in Football League history. Luckily, when I rang the Football League the next day to confirm it, they did confirm it was a record. And the other best thing about that was that his parents, who live on the Isle of Wight, bit of a nightmare to get to on a Tuesday night from Bournemouth, they left before he'd even come on. They didn't think he was going to get on that night.
No.
So they missed the big moment. They were listening in the car radio as their son made history.
Oh,
brilliant.
Love them. Right, we're almost out of time for this week, but there is just about enough time for Motti to take on our quick fire quiz.
Okay, John is back with us then for the 60-second quiz. Basically, just as many snappy answers about your career as we can manage in that time. First of all, what's the one item you take with you to every commentary?
My packet of felt tip pens, because they are what I use to sort of make my notes on my chart and on my team lists, and I couldn't be without them.
Which co-commentator has kept you on your toes the most over the course of your career?
Oh, Jimmy Hill, definitely. The late Jimmy Hill, because he was so unpredictable, enjoyable to work with, but you didn't quite know what he was going to do or say next. So that was quite a good grounding for me.
What's your favourite ever game that you've commentated?
I would think probably England winning 5-1 in Germany under Sven-Göran Eriksson. That came up so unexpectedly. You know, we didn't often beat the big powers of world football away from home, and that 5-1 with Michael Owen's hat-trick came as a huge surprise, but it was also a fantastic night to be there, and for any Englishman doing the commentary, it was terrific.
And on the same theme, if you could cover any sporting event, go back in time, what would it be?
Well, I think the 1966 World Cup final would spring to mind, wouldn't it? It's the only time England have ever won it. I was just a jobbing reporter on a local paper when that happened, and I'm sure only one person could have done it. And of course, it was Ken Wolstenholme who came up with probably the best commentary line of all time when he said, "They think it's all over." So, yeah, if you could go back in time, that would be one I would pick out, certainly.
And what change would you make to make your job easier? One change?
One change, take the players back to proper numbers. I'm fed up with doing, I don't know what Sam and your commentators feel, but I'm fed up with seeing players wearing 55 and 62. I'm not saying they should all wear 1 to 11 again, by the way. That would be taking it back too far. But when the Premier League get the clubs to name their squads at the beginning of the season, I think there should be a rule that you number them 1 to 25. And they stick with that number. Now, all right, a young player may come into it later in the season. You'd have to have a little bit of a scope to go up to 30. But I think at the moment, it's a jumble.
That's it. Brilliant. Love speaking to Motti this week. Brilliant to have everyone on the programme. Thanks for tuning in and downloading. Thanks to John Motson for sparing us some of his precious time. Alex, Michelle and I will be back next week, and we'll speak to you soon. If you want to tweet us, it's at AFCGeeks. It's the same on Instagram. And remember to rate and to subscribe to us on iTunes.